Hey guys, welcome to Unpacking Design. I'm Mike LaValle.
And Tim Ung, and this is a show where we tell you about products and ideas that relate to designers all over the world.
Hey, what's up everybody? Welcome back to Unpacking Design. Tim, today we have a topic that's been a little bit on my mind. We've been sort of working on a project at my office, and I was called in as a, let's call it a design ringer.
Okay.
So I'm not on this project normally. And it's another team in the office. And I was in some ways flattered that I was like essentially brought onto the team to help with a design challenge, which isn't always the case in an office, but you know, whatever. I did what I could and we figured it out, I think. But basically the team had a design that they had to work through before they could do a whole bunch of other things in the project. So it started me thinking, not necessarily in terms of collaboration or teamwork, but in terms of who sort of owns the design to some degree. Like who actually, because I'm there for like a couple days, right? And I'm there for feedback and critique and to do design sketches for several hours throughout the week.
Right.
But at the end of the day, I'm walking away from this project and I'm probably never going to touch it again because I'm not on this team. I'm not, you know, I'm not part of it. So I didn't really want to take the heavy discussion point today about like intellectual property necessarily, but I just wanted to unpack sort of design control or design ownership or design, I think you understand what I'm
saying. Yeah, I think design ownership. So if we unpack ownership, I think is a really good way of framing it because the way that you explained it makes a lot of sense. I think a lot of firms, especially in the design world, always focus on it in this sense where you can pull someone in to do the design portion, but then you pass it on kind of like the old school Ford manufacturing plant assembly idea where someone does one thing and then they step out and then it moves down the line to the next group who does something else. There's right. also that similarity to it.
Yep. So. Yeah, and I to clarify, it's not that I don't think that this team could have designed something. I think that they had been looking at the same problem for months on end and were getting stuck having looked at the same thing. So they brought somebody in who was trusted to help with the design that could bring a fresh set of eyes to the problem.
Yeah.
The problem. But it just started me thinking down this path of, you know, when I consider the projects I've worked on just in general and for an office or for a design firm, I struggle with sort of what I actually own to a degree, you know, because. And I think I recognized this fairly early after I got out of school, which is why we've talked about this a little bit, I think, on the podcast, where I've entered a lot of competitions and done a lot of side projects because I wanted to have my own, and I think you're doing this too with your 30 by 30, where you have your own kind of library of projects outside of an office
right.
so that you have full autonomy on sort of what you are doing and you can control everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's something really important to talk about is who owns those designs. So like you for the 30 by 30 completely own all of the work that you're doing because it's yours.
Mm-hmm.
And the competitions entries that I work on are all mine. And it's important to me to think about it because whether it's to sort of share things with other people or potentially get another job or have the autonomy again to decide and choose how you share work, I think is really important. And I just kind of want to unpack that today because it's just been really kind of on my mind.
Yeah. Let me just ask you a question to clarify if I'm understanding it correctly. So when you're talking about this idea, are you looking at it from the perspective of if an employee works at a firm and they're designing all these projects for 10 years, 15 years, whatever it is, and they decide to leave the firm and try to build a portfolio, do they have any ownership of the work that they've done within those 10 to 15 years? Is that kind of how you're framing this?
Yes. I would say that's one part of it. And I don't mean literal ownership necessarily. I mean how much does a person have to be a part of a design solution
right.
to have what they consider ownership over that design? Mm-hmm. So if you go to a graphic design firm, if you go to an architecture firm, what is that threshold?
Yeah.
And I'm kind of bringing it up as more of a little bit of a debate of mm-hmm. just to talk through of what is that point where I can say very clearly that I had a very direct role in shaping this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good topic because I think it's always vague for everybody, and it's also based on your personality. So some people might have just jumped into a project and designed, let's say, the first floor of a 20-story building.
Right.
And then they'll walk out and they'll claim ownership of the entire building, right. when in fact they only designed the one floor.
Right.
But because they had some kind of input throughout the design stages, it makes them feel as if they own that part of it. And then there are other people who are more on the shyer side and don't feel like they can claim ownership unless they've seen the project through from beginning to end.
Right.
Whether that means from the beginning of conceptual design to the end of it, or the beginning of construction to the end of construction. Because there's, in architecture, there's that difference too.
Sure.
That you have what's on paper, but you have what's really built.
Yep.
And I think in graphic design, it's, and in all of the other fields, it's the same idea where when you jump onto a project and you're helping out and you're making refinements to a design, do you own that part of it too?
Right.
Because it might just be a very simple typography kind of modification to a graphic design, or it could be a slight modification to a box design
yeah.
or, you know, packaging. And all of these things had input from someone else, and it might have been the latest intern, right? So does the intern claim ownership of the design of that box because of their slight modification?
Right.
You know, well, it's the same debate at Apple, right? Steve Jobs passed away, so who's owning the new designs for that?
Right.
And there's clearly people working on the different models and prototypes there, but when people think of Apple, they still think that it's Steve Jobs' design.
Yeah, and even if you go down to the level of like a John Ivey, or
right.
like somebody who is maybe synonymous with Apple product design, he doesn't necessarily design, you know, I like when he, this is like a sidestep a little bit, but I love when he's in his little like monologue-y type advertisements
yeah.
for the new products, because he's like, you know, we painstakingly from the diamond mines of Africa, like took these pieces and like stitched them together with like such precision that, you know,
right.
it's like the craziest like description of a product ever,
yeah.
right? And you feel like it's his product. And I'm not saying that he doesn't have a significant portion mm-hmm. of, you know, the input for that. But there's hundreds, if not thousands, of people who have, like you said, I thought the assembly line was actually a really good example, where mm-hmm. there's engineers and there's designers that are very concerned with this type of thing,
mm-hmm.
and then this type of thing, and then this type of thing. Mm-hmm. And they all have their own specialties.
Yeah.
It's not like one person designs a phone.
Right. And there's another example that I think of at a larger scale as well, where product design companies like OXO, the company that makes all of the kitchen supplies, all of the handles, all of these kinds of things, their products are designed by IDEO. IDEO mm-hmm. also designs the Apple products too, like the first Apple mouse came from IDEO.
Right.
And when you think of the Apple mouse, you think of Apple. So Apple claims the ownership of that because they hired IDEO to design it for them.
Right.
So in that sense, what does IDEO have to say, right? Like,
right.
do they have any ownership of this, and do they claim it? Do they put it on their website? Do they say, I designed the Apple mouse?
Right.
Or is that something that they can't claim because of intellectual property? And that's
right.
where I think the design profession is not as black and white. It's
sure.
a very gray area, you know?
Taking it in a subject that is probably a little bit closer to some of my interests is in video games, it's not uncommon for a developer. So usually there's a developer who makes the game and there's a publisher who distributes mm-hmm. it. And it's not uncommon, like probably the most famous example is there's the video game series Halo,
mm-hmm.
which was developed by the developer Bungie. If anybody plays video games or plays sort of first-person shooters, you'll know that Bungie used to be owned by Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
Bungie left that, and they're on their own now, and they have developed a game named Destiny. And for all intents and purposes, Bungie doesn't own Halo anymore. Halo games are still being made by Microsoft and by their other developer. But I will, as a person, always associate that game, Halo, with Bungie, because they were the creators, they were the developers who made it happen in the first place.
Right.
And it's interesting to me because they, on some level, they have to let that go as an IP because of how the, either the contracts were made or how they were established under the Microsoft umbrella. And it's just very, it's not, I don't want to say necessarily scary, but it's very disheartening sometimes when, as a designer, I feel like you don't necessarily have either the recognition or the literal ownership of some of the intellectual property that you can kind of go after. And it's, to me, it's just, it's not even an ego thing. It's just more of a, like, you spent that time as an individual or as a team to really come up with something creative. And what is the line of, and maybe it's enough for me to know in the back of my mind that this team or a team at some point under the, you know, name Bungie made this thing, and they will always be recognized. Like, it's not like anybody's saying that they didn't make Halo or they didn't do this thing, but it's just, and even going back to the example that I had at the beginning, I don't care whether or not I am sort of an author on this design solution that I came in to help with. It just started making me thinking, because when I know that there are design suggestions that I made that completely changed the look of what they were doing before I started it. And it started making me think, okay, if they go down this path, and I know you know that as soon as you make the conceptual changes in architecture, you know, as soon as you keep exponentially growing how much different it can be, because you go to materials, you go to how those things are sort of put together, and then you get to the actual construction after you've detailed it that way, and it could be even different from there. So this one kernel of a design change that I helped implement has completely changed the trajectory of the entire look of this edition that I was working with. And I don't know, it just, it's, in some ways it feels like it's a little bit, it's always just sort of like poked at my side a little bit. Like, as designers, we don't have, I guess, more authority in some ways over what we're working on. In some, and not in every instance. If you're on your own or you're like completely in control of your own work, and or you're just working on stuff by yourself, it's very clear that you did that thing. But I don't know. It just feels like we live in a world now where I don't know, like, I will never know that some certain people design certain things because of, like, your example I thought was great, where somebody hires somebody else and the person at the end of that chain who actually made the design decisions is never sort of even acknowledged, because in the perception of the public or of the world, that person doesn't even exist in relation to the design chain that made it happen overall.
Yeah, and when you were describing the idea about the game and Halo and now moving on from Halo, that company and that example made me realize that people from the outside, like regular people like us too, when we look at these companies, we don't even know those individuals, because not just in like our area of design, it's everywhere, because we don't see the names of those people. And at the same time, is that, I guess, taking the opposite perspective on it, is it really so bad? And because when you watch a movie like the most recent Avengers movie, when you see the credits at the end, they did credit all the firms that worked on it, right? Like, you can see everyone that worked to put this thing together.
Which is a lot of people.
It's a lot of people. And they'll put the names of owners on there sometimes, like the partners who are in charge or whatever. But they never get down to the person who made the 3D models or who did the renderings or who made the graphics or who did the typography or who set the scenes or who designed the setting and actually built it by hand, right? Like, you don't see those people.
Right.
And it goes back to this idea, even back to the Roman era, where the person who designed and the person who built it, only the people at the very top of the chain are the ones who are ever known.
Right.
They're the only names that are ever remembered. The rest of the people are always slaves, right? Like, they were just at the bottom of the line, slaving away, making things. And maybe it's something that has to start changing, but the bigger question is, how do you do that?
Yeah, I don't know, you know, maybe taking from an even different stance, I don't even know if you should or can.
Yeah.
Like, I've seen, let's take it to, like, award ceremonies where you have these high-profile designs, people, whether it's in architecture or graphic design or any kind of design, almost every field has their own set of award ceremonies, mm-hmm. whether it's to recognize people or designs or whatever, right? A lot of times, especially in the last 10, 15 years, I've seen a lot of these awards have, like, let's say there's a booklet or whatever, or something that is a press release. You'll mm-hmm. see everybody who worked on it, or most people who worked on mm-hmm. it. But even if you do, I don't necessarily think it's about individual recognition sometimes, because if I listed, you know, every single person who worked on a building design, mm-hmm. you know, that's going to be a couple pages long.
Yeah.
And it's not that they don't all necessarily deserve recognition, but I wonder if sometimes it's just because it's easier. Like, if I'm following a high-rise project that's happening in New York City, right? Mm-hmm. And there's probably 1,000+ people who are making that happen, just from design to construction to whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it necessarily does matter as, like, a person on the outside to me, whether or not every single person is recognized, just because at the end of the day, I just appreciate and recognize that there probably are those people. I don't need to know them. I don't need to know, like, each person's backstory mm-hmm. and, like, how many family members, you know, are in their immediate family, right. and yeah. what their names are. It's like, I yeah. don't need to go to that level. But I just wonder if there's a better way for... I just wonder if there's a better way to, like, does that person, let's say I don't know the person who is working, you know, the 1,000th person who's working on a skyscraper design, mm-hmm. how much autonomy or how much ownership do they have over that overall design? You know,
right.
like the people who made the Empire State Building, you know, way back when, mm-hmm. I don't even know really any of those people, you know, like, it's been not lost to history, but it's in terms of perception, I just know that it's an important building in New York City.
Yeah.
And I know that it's something to be revered and something to be appreciated, but I don't know if, you know, is there a person, I mean, probably there is there a person who originally helped design that and then it's been carried along on their family's lineage mm-hmm. for, I don't know.
Right. I don't think it's as important. Like, from my perspective, I don't think it's as important for everyone's individual name to be listed mm-hmm. as a contributor for something. I think at smaller scales, it makes sense.
Right.
But when you get to something like the most recent one is the TWA terminal in
sure.
New York City, when they talked about having over 178 consultants on that project
right.
over the course of 4 years, how are you going to get 178 consultants to break down their team members and then provide a list of 3,000 people? And then who's going to remember that list, right?
Yeah, because
who's
going
to care?
When you say consultants, it's not an individual. It's like
it's a
group.
Firm, right? Yeah. So now take that idea. And now for me, if we flip it and look at it from the perspective of the person who's working at those firms or
sure.
working at
right.
those groups, the one thing that I'm starting to see as something that is not helping in our society, and I'm not sure if it's universal for the design profession, but I have a feeling it is, but it's especially true in architecture, where people like us who are employed at a firm
uh-huh.
or whatever, most of the time when we do projects at the firm and we contribute to that firm's growth, right, and we complete projects as a team, when you leave that firm, this idea of intellectual property and what you can claim as your
sure.
part in it becomes a gray area as well. Let's say you decided to leave a firm and you started your own practice.
Right.
In a lot of cases, it would look bad in a lot of ways if you were to take the projects that your firm worked on and start claiming it as your own to get started.
Right.
Whereas in the past, that wasn't such a bad thing. Like, think about before technology was around and someone worked at a prolific architect firm like Louis Sullivan or at Frank Lloyd Wright's firm. And after some time, they left and they started doing their own thing. And as they did that, they would claim the projects that they worked on with Frank Lloyd Wright as their own, and then they would use that as a jumping point to then get clients.
Yep.
In our world today, that's something that's now being hindered by contracts that people sign, non-compete clauses, so on and so forth.
Yep.
And I think that's a bigger discussion we should be having too, because that's an area that everyone is afraid to talk about because it's a hush-hush thing, like, hey, can I do this, can I not? And in reality, I don't know if it's that bad to be able to showcase the projects that you had a significant role in as you apply and work at other firms or as you start your own practice. Because if you're 55 years old and you can't claim the 55-year-old project that you've worked on, you know, 30 years of projects, you have nothing to help you.
Right.
You have to start from the ground up.
Yeah, and it, without getting into the maybe particular issues of somebody leaving or whatever. So like the first thing that comes to mind is, let's say there's an adversarial relationship there and people don't want you to take stuff with you because they don't like you anymore. Or it ended badly, I guess. So we're not talking about that. I think what we're talking about is being able to, when you have had such an impact on the work of the place that you worked at, that you should have some sort of way to be recognized for that work.
Right.
And whether or not it's, you know, and it is a very gray area because I see a lot of people's portfolios. I see a lot of, especially younger people.
Mm-hmm.
I find that, you know, somebody's taking a rendering from like, let's go back to the TWA as an example. There's probably an intern somewhere or a junior architect or an engineer or whatever who took a rendering that was made by somebody completely different and said, this is my work. I made this building. And that's wrong to a degree because it's like you didn't make the rendering.
Right.
You weren't probably high enough on the design team to say, oh, I contributed or I made this the way it looks today. But you can say something to the effect of, I participated in this role, or I did this thing for this project, and it's better because I helped with it. Now, that said, if you go to the other end of the spectrum and you have a person, like you said, with 30 years of experience, it's probably a little bit easier to make the leap to say, oh, well, I made this, you know, entire project function the way it is. It looks the way it does today because I started from A to Z. And now we're here, you know, and this is a photo. I'm just even thinking about that. If you get a photographer to take a photo of a building after it's done, can you share that photo? Like, let's say it's IP for, you know, it's something that the firm purchased from a photographer.
Right.
That is that firm's because they purchased it from the photographer, which means that you don't necessarily even have the right to take it. It just becomes this like weird gray area for me, especially if you're trying to just like, I think a lot of people have the best of intentions just to be able to share what they've done with the world or with other people. But, and I don't necessarily want this to become the focus of our conversation, but it is something I think we should touch on is like what literally do you think people have? And I know this could get into even grayer of an area because of contractual obligations or not, but what do you feel like is an appropriate way for people to share stuff if there are a lot of, like, let's call them things in their way or, you know, obstacles, I guess, in their way to be able to just share something with somebody?
I think the way that you were phrasing it earlier is the best way to do it, where you say what your role was on the project. Mm-hmm. If you had a minor role on something large and you wanted to use it for the name of that thing,
right.
I think it's okay, but you have to be clear about what you did. If you were the person who went and stapled all of the books that were printed, right? Like you should be able to say that you did that. What I think you can't do, which is done very commonly now in the 21st century, is people who have the smaller roles on a project will claim to have had the larger roles, and then they'll step into that larger role if they were switching to a different position.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't know where to start.
Right.
And I've seen this happen with certain colleagues of mine where they've tried that, and after a month or so, they were completely lost in what they were trying to do because they didn't have that role before. So they didn't have the comfort or the muscle memory of doing the tasks that are associated.
Right.
So that's where it gets really bad. The other part of it is if you are starting a practice of your own and you left on good terms, I think typically if you spoke with the owner or whoever at the firms where you left about what you're intending to do, they can probably let you know if it's good or not, you know?
Right.
But in some cases, it's also scary to ask because you're asking them to use work that you've done for them, that they paid you for, in order to use that for, let's say, a proposal for a project that they might be going for as well if it's a public project.
Yeah.
And I think it's a good discussion just because we're in a society now where people want to see that you've done work before.
Right.
And how could you show that if you worked for someone else for 20 years before starting your own practice?
Yeah.
And then you're told that you can't use that in your portfolio at all.
Right.
So what can you claim? What do you do? Do you do what I'm doing with a 30 by 30 and you try and develop 30 projects to have?
Sure.
And if you do that, how do you have any leg to stand on if it has to have gone that one step further of showing that you had a paying client or to show that whatever, like there are things that come with it. And I think a lot of it is also driven by the idea that a lot of firms are staying around a lot longer these days. Like there are firms that are around and they've been around for over 75 years now, and they're going to be around for another 100.
Yep.
So if you have that legacy, those firms can continually get more products because they have what society's looking for.
Right.
But when you start off as a smaller practice, how do you then start to scale, or how do you even start?
Right.
Is it even possible?
I think it probably does help you if you are in the situation where you're leaving a place and you're doing something that is not even feasible for you to do when you leave. So an example would be maybe you worked on very high-end multi-million dollar super projects that you won't be able to get those commissions right away anyway.
Right.
So the firm that you're leaving or the place that you're leaving doesn't care to a degree probably whether or not you say that you worked on something because you're not going to literally be able to compete with them anyway. You know, at least not in the short term.
Right.
And I think that once you get to the place where you probably could compete with that, if that was what you were trying to do and trying to be wherever, you know, the same kind of place that you left from, but on your own terms, you're probably going to get to a body of work by the time you actually are there that where it won't matter anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the only place where I could see where it would really matter is if you were working at take an architecture firm example. Let's say you're working at a place that does high-end homes, and you want to do high-end homes when you leave, and it's something that feasibly an architect can do if they have the type of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And they could, right out the gate, as long as they had clients, they could probably do more of that work.
Mm-hmm.
That might be a conflict, especially if you're still in that same area or whatever. And I think knowing a little bit about what you want to do with the thing that you're trying to share is really important to the discussion, because like going back to my original sort of story, I personally don't, like, I'll be happy if it ultimately looks like something that I helped contribute with, but there are also those projects where I just know I'm helping a cause, or I know I'm helping a project be successful because I could look at it with a fresh set of eyes, and you know, I feel confident in my design skills in general, so I am able to help that, you know, move forward.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, I kind of don't care if it looks like what I helped them with, because I just want to sort of like almost shake things up and make it more viable as an overall project.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think you really need to ask yourself what your intent is of what like, let's say you're working on a project that you love at a at an office, mm-hmm. whether it's a graphic design, industrial design, you're making something that you really love. I think it would be important to have a discussion at some point to say, look, I really like this thing mm-hmm. in particular. Is this okay if I share this with people? And even doing that before the project has ended and having discussions internally and saying, look, is this something that we can share? Is this something that I can, you know, not necessarily put my stamp on, but put my name or associate myself with mm-hmm. because it's a really interesting project and I feel like more people should know about it.
Right.
Having more discussions like that might help the conversation too, because I think part of the problem is if you go to a place where you work, then you at the end, after it has become successful mm-hmm. already, say, look, I really want to take this with me. I'm leaving now
yeah.
or whatever.
Right.
You know, or even if you're not leaving and you just want to, you don't know what the place is that you're working at is going to say, because let's say there's another person on the project who feels just like you do mm-hmm. and they feel equally like they have ownership over the project more than you do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, who's right? I mean,
yeah.
is it right because, as you were saying before, the person with seniority who has established themselves and mm-hmm. maybe they only did one hand sketch, but it's the hand sketch that like generated the entire project.
Yeah, like the napkin sketches.
Yeah. Like, is that, does that person have more ownership? You know, usually that person literally does have more ownership, but mm-hmm. they didn't painstakingly come up with the construction details or the design details to make the overall vision work.
Yeah. It's also a tough area. It reminds me of recent discussions that I've heard throughout design firms everywhere, where you'll be working on a new project that comes in. That new project has a great client who's giving you a lot of design
right.
flexibility.
Right.
And you've got this crazy conceptual thing right. that like will change the world, right? And then the question comes up, hey, can we show this? Can we share this on social media? Can I share it on my Instagram? Can I share it on my Facebook?
Right.
And then the first thing that comes down from the top is no. No, you can't do that. And then it's like, why? And then there's so many other areas that come with it. Like, is this a confidential client? Is this a confidential
right.
project? When can we share it? When is it okay to share it? And then it even gets down to like how much control you have as that person
right.
and how much control the person above you has. So a project manager might be able to say, yeah, it's ready to be shared. Go ahead and share it. Or they might say, hey, share it, but you can only share it under the firm's Instagram. You can't share it under your own.
Right.
You can't. Also, don't put your name in the comments section or don't, you know, just have it there, right? And I think this is a really good area to get into because it's one that everyone wants to share. Like
yeah.
in the 21st century, sharing is what people do. You go
right.
out, you take a picture of something and you share it and you say, hey, look, check it out. This is what I'm working on. So that your friends and family could see it. Now it's become an omen to do that at a design firm because you
right.
have so much creative things going out
right.
and the only people who are allowed to share it are the owners of the practice. Right, but the owners of the practice don't really understand how social media works in a lot of cases because they're
right.
older or they don't believe in it or whatever. You know, things like that come up too. And then it's like, if you are the person working on something, then this idea of ownership really comes to light because there are so many opportunities throughout the refinement of a design that you can actually share because it's something that you're working on. But because you're doing it under the firm, it's such a gray area that no one knows how to maneuver.
I'll take this to a different level, and this is because I recently, and you know Peter McKinnon?
Yeah.
You actually introduced me to Peter
yeah.
McKinnon. He's a photographer, a fairly famous photographer, and he has a really big YouTube channel. So one of the videos that I was looking at recently was this, and I didn't even watch the whole video, but I think you'll understand where I'm going.
Yeah.
He's looking at the difference between a, and this is related to the Golden Gate Bridge, somebody as a tourist taking a photo of the Golden Gate Bridge versus a photographer taking the same mm-hmm. kind of photo, but from a place that is, you know, the lighting is different or the camera setup is different or the just the way that the photo is established is different, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is you can tell immediately, even in the thumbnail of the YouTube video, that there's a difference between a professional taking the photo and the average tourist.
Yeah.
But then I thought about it from a completely different stance, is who even owns that as an image? Because theoretically, neither of those people, even if they were a tourist or a professional photographer, owns the design of the Golden Gate Bridge.
Right.
Which it just kind of blew my mind for a second because I was just like, on some level, does it matter? Like, as long as it looks nice, I mean, that's great. And then I understand, I'm not trying to diminish the profession of photography, but I mean it from a point of, it's so difficult to pin down what, who owns what in today, because, I mean, I could theoretically take my iPhone and if I had the same background knowledge and sort of professional experience of a photographer, I could take something probably with my iPhone and have something that's fairly similar in quality or lighting. I mean, that's the point of his tutorials, is to show you the difference between the two. But I would still never own the design of the Golden Gate Bridge.
Right.
Like, it's something that's unattainable because it's already been established.
Yeah, and in relation to that example of photography, you probably don't know this since you don't get into it as much as I do, but there are actually places and buildings that are copywritten. So you can't photograph those places and claim it or sell it. Huh. So an example of that is the Eiffel Tower at night. You're not allowed to take photography of any photographs of the Eiffel Tower at night and then claim it as your own.
Wow.
And if you do, they have the right to then either sue you or give you a notice to take it down. And
I didn't know that.
And so this whole idea behind creative endeavors comes down to things like that.
Right.
How do you even know that?
Right.
You don't go scouring the internet like, hey, can I photograph 2277 Madison Avenue? Like.
Right.
There might just be a shack, right? And you're taking a picture of this shack, but for some reason, it's a historic shack, and the person had a right to it since 1794.
See, somebody's going to go look up that address.
Yeah, right? I don't even know if it's a real address, but it was just an example. It's like, how crazy does it get in terms of ownership and what you can and can't do? And the other part that comes to it is, how much of a disadvantage are we getting to as a design profession, right? If a graphic designer has something that they are inspired by and they put it out into the world, is it illegal for someone to take a photograph of that poster on a wall, right? As a designer, I would want people to give me more exposure, especially if they loved my work enough to take a photograph of it. I'd let them do it, right? But there are a lot of different areas that I think are starting to inhibit the way that creative people can start moving in the world, especially with all these new laws and hidden things. It's kind of like a hidden mine that's just waiting for you to step on it so that they can sue you and get your money, right? It's like if you take a picture of the World Trade Center, for example, I did a sketch, a hand sketch of the World Trade Center, and I was trying to sell the sketch imprinted onto a pillowcase, and I actually had a notice to take it down. And I was like, I don't understand how this works, but supposedly it was a copywriting issue. And it wasn't to me, it was through a website called Redbubble. It's basically a dropshipping website. Yeah. They take your graphic and do what you want. And I was just like, wow, who would have thought that a hand sketch of a place is also illegal, right?
Right.
How do you take a hand sketch of a place and then say, hey, I don't even own this, but I just hand sketched it from my brain and hand to the paper, and now I don't even own this, right? So It puts fear into a lot of designers when you get a notice like that, because it makes you think, like, what can I do? Mm-hmm. Another good example is even like a domain name, right? Like Pat Flynn, who has smartpassiveincome.com. Before having that, he had an architecture website to help people pass an exam for LEED, the Energy Council. And so he had all of this on there, and he named his website something with LEED in it, like LEED exam prep or something.
Yeah, right.
And then he had a notice to take it down, and they were going to give him a lawsuit if he didn't.
Right.
So now even in that case, like a name became a part of it as well. And I understand the name more than a photograph of a place or a hand sketch of a place. But how far is it going to go? Is it getting to a point where no one owns anything because all the corporations own it already? You know, and now even phrases are being trademarked. So,
well, even so, like the, and I know you don't necessarily game as much anymore, but Fortnite, the big issue on that game, which is like blowing up, it's like one of the most popular games in the world.
Yeah.
There's issues with people who are celebrities who have danced before or have like signature dance moves, and the characters in this game also do like almost one for one carbon copies of what these dances are. So like the example comes to the top of my mind is Carlton from the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. He does like this like sort of like swoopy sort of dance move.
Yeah.
And he started, I think he like literally sued the people who made Fortnite because it's his trademark dance. And I don't know if it's even really trademark, but like the fact that you can take a dance and you, like, I just don't know. Like, I just have no idea who has real ownership over things.
Yeah, so I think we started this episode off in a more like concise, like here, this is what we're thinking about. And now we're getting to this point of what is intellectual property getting to,
right?
You know, and how far is it going to go? Because if a phrase like blank space from Taylor Swift is becoming a trademark phrase, then now we're, and we might need to beep that part out just because I just realized I used it in this podcast. But
oh my God.
But because of that, it makes people like me a little more afraid of the things that we do. Like how much research do we need to do before we do something now?
You should know that 2277 Madison Ave is a place.
Is it really? Wow. Look at that. So I think this is a good point to end this podcast episode on, just because we've gotten to...
Yeah, there is no resolution.
There isn't. We just got to this broad area where we wanted to leave our listeners with something to be a little fearful of, I guess is the whole point of this.
Yeah.
And I think for me, what I got out of this episode is just that if you really want to get some ownership of something that you're doing, you have to ask the people at the right times. Like if you're working at a firm and you eventually want to use a project and you're working on that project now, let them know and ask them, hey, can I share some of this on my social media, my personal social media? And even have a sit down with the partners at your company and ask them, you know, what is it that I can do if I were to leave the firm? And just let them know that you're not planning to leave, but you're just trying to plan your future.
Right?
Because if you're 30 years old, 40 years old, and you have time ahead of you, and you really know that eventually you want to start something of your own, you can always ask, hey, can I use some of the photography? Am I allowed to claim some rights to this project just so that if I start a practice, I can use it in a portfolio and try and get off the ground? You know, and if you do it in the right way and you eventually leave that firm, there's a higher chance of the partners at that firm offering you opportunities that are too small for them, but fall in line with what you're trying to do.
Right. And I think the other thing on top of that is that probably the best way you can do this is one of two directions. One is to either just generate your own projects and just try to have as much autonomy as you can over those. So like what you're doing with the 30 by 30 is a perfect example.
Right.
Or if you are in a situation where you're working on what are essentially another group's or firm's or place's projects, I would actually say try to be as ingrained and as invested in those projects as you possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
Make your role as important as you can without stepping on toes, obviously, but like try to ask for more opportunities on the project. Mm-hmm. Try to become more of an important player in the group so that you, even if you can't take literal images with you, you can describe your role in a more robust way.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, that was a great discussion on ownership.
All right. Thanks for joining us, guys.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to another episode of Unpacking Design. And you can check us out anytime at the unpackingdesign.com website.
And you can also find us on iTunes and anywhere else that you listen to podcasts. Please remember to leave a review and share this podcast with someone you know.